go into the zone when you're covering a conflict like that, where it's all kicking off as you're there and you are expected to service all these different platforms, it is incredibly demanding. I mean, it is all consuming. There is nothing in your world during the course of that week or whatever, however long it was, except for this war and your work. In the end, I think it's the sort of thing you either find it incredibly stressful and think, why on earth would anyone want to do this? Or you find it tremendously exciting and you think, why on earth would anyone want to do anything else? I obviously fell into the latter category.
Clarissa Ward has an incredible ability to be in the wrong place at the right time. Throughout her career as a foreign correspondent, she has covered invasions, sieges, uprisings, and sheer devastation, reporting from Russia, Lebanon, Iraq, and more recently inside Syria, where her coverage for CNN, where she currently works as the network's senior international correspondent, has garnered her with the prestigious George Foster Peabody Award. At a time when journalists in war zones face increasingly elevated risks and dangers, Clarissa's work has become all the more important for giving voice to those civilians caught on the front line. I'm very pleased to say that Clarissa Ward joins me now in Midori House for the big interview. Welcome to the big interview. Thank you very much for joining us today. I wanted to start by talking about last year when you made an address to the United Nations about the siege of Aleppo. And you said then that you've been covering war for 12 years, but have never experienced anything like Syria. Why did you say that? What makes this conflict different, do you think?
I mean, I think there are a number of components that make Syria unique, and specifically the siege of Aleppo. My career really began primarily in Iraq in about 2005 in terms of field work. And obviously, Iraq and Afghanistan were very different types of battlefields. Most of us journalists, in order to gain access to these battlefields, were embedding with US or British or coalition forces. And that provides you or gives you some degree of protection. You are staying with a kind of military that is somewhat sophisticated, if not very sophisticated. So that was one type of experience that I had had. The thing that made Syria different, aside from the fact that, of course, you weren't embedding with First World soldiers of some of the top armies in the world, was that there was such a disparity between the munitions and sophistication and fighting power of one side, being the army of the regime of Bashar al-Assad, and then the rebels on the other side, who were always somewhat disorganized. There was no clear chain of command. They didn't have the same type of weaponry. They were often using just light weapons, AK-47s, maybe a few RPGs, if they were very lucky, some anti-tank missiles. And it is somewhat surreal to be in a city like Aleppo and listen to these barrel bombs falling down out of the sky, having no idea where they are going to land. And there's a really sort of pit of fear in your stomach that forms when you have no clue as to where the bomb is going to land, when you have no idea of which house is going to get hit next. It provides a level of anxiety. All war zones are scary, obviously, but Aleppo was scary in a different way because you had so little defense and you had so little idea of what was going to get hit next. It made it very difficult to think strategically in a way that perhaps in other war zones we had been able to do.
So obviously Syria has come to define your career in recent years, but I wanted to go right back to when you first started out. Today you're CNN's senior international correspondent. But actually, in many ways, your career began with CNN in the Moscow Bureau in 2002. And I wanted to ask you if you could think back to that time a little bit. I mean, you know, 2002, Russia was in the middle of the Second Chechen War. Vladimir Putin was only in president for several years. First of all, what drew you to the profession at that time? What took you to Moscow? What made you say, I want to be a journalist? And not just a journalist working in the US or in the UK. What took you to Moscow? Why did you want to be a foreign correspondent at that time?
Well, You know, I think sometimes it can sound like a bit of a cliche, but it really is true. 9/11 happened in my senior or my final year at Yale University, where I was studying comparative literature, and I was studying Russian, French, and Italian literature specifically. My father had given me a copy of Anna Karenina when I was 14 years old, and I became kind of obsessed with Russia and Russian literature and Russian poetry from that moment on. So when 9/11 happened, it became immediately clear to me that there was a kind of complete breakdown of communication and a lack of understanding and knowledge about certain parts of the world on both sides. And so I really felt a strong sense of conviction that I wanted to try to learn as much as I could about the world and see as much of it as I could, and then act as a kind of communicator, in a sense, between various different parts of the world in order to try to facilitate some better understanding. I mean, I was 21 years old, I should say, and at university, so full of bright, idealistic ideas. And so I was taking basic Russian, and there presented itself an opportunity to be an intern in the Moscow bureau at CNN, which of course was tremendously exciting. I mean, that was pretty much my dream, would be to start out somewhere like that. And it very quickly became it was a steep learning curve. There was a lot happening in Russia at that time. While I was there, there was the famous theater siege that took place of the Nord-Ost musical production. It was a little bit baptism by fire, really. We suddenly had all these different correspondents being flown in from around the world, and the bureau was this hive of activity, and people were dying in the hospital from this sleeping agent, basically, that they had used to try to subdue the hostage takers. And there was a mixture of kind of, you know, exhaustion and excitement and energy. And from that moment on, I think I really was just sort of, I hesitate to use the word addicted because I think it can have negative connotations, but I knew that this was something I really wanted to keep doing with my life. And there was a learning curve, as I said, where you just felt like suddenly you're just taking in so much information at such a hugely accelerated rate that I found that very exciting.
In 2003, you moved back to the US and you spend a couple of years there working in for Fox for a couple of years. And then Fox takes you to Beirut in 2006 and you move out there.
So what I did was I worked on the overnight assignment desk at the Fox News Channel at 23, which I think we can all agree that I really started at the very bottom, definitely paid my dues. And then after one trip to Baghdad as a producer, I quit Fox and moved to Beirut as a freelancer and would work regularly for Fox going back and forth to Baghdad. I really wanted to be in front of the camera, and I kept asking them. And finally, because Baghdad had become so dangerous and such an awful assignment, frankly, that no one else wanted it, they said, okay, you can have a shot at being on air if you go for Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, which was it's a plum 6-week assignment. So I said I would. Saddam Hussein was executed a few days after Christmas, and really I was in the live shot position for days on end without moving.
Let's just come back to Beirut though, because as you say, you were based there as a freelancer for some time, and when you arrive into Beirut, it's 2006. Had the invasion begun then, the sort of Lebanese war with Israel, had that begun at that
time?
No.
So I got there earlier. I arrived there in 2005. And by 2006, when the war happened, Beirut was really my home. And I think that was quite hard for me, because the only way going back and forth from war zones really works is if you have your home base, which is kind of stable. So I would go back and forth to Baghdad. And it had already been some tough times. We'd survived a triple suicide car bombing at the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad, which was probably my closest experience with death. And really, you know, I was 25 years old, so I was young. And Beirut was the place that I went to in between these assignments to have some modicum of normalcy in my life.
And then an invasion begins.
And then the war began, and it was very ugly and quite frightening and all the more personal to me because it was my home. So it was a difficult time. At the same time, it was you felt like you really wanted to be covering it because you did understand the dynamics in Lebanon. Lebanon is a very complex and convoluted political system. And so having the knowledge that I did about Beirut, it felt somewhat good to be able to put it to use.
I see. But you mean sort of actually the kind of the very rich mosaic of trouble there in Beirut. Actually, in some ways, you can kind of, you know, you can read some of the big stories of the region in Beirut itself, can't you? It tells you those bigger stories, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everything that plays out across the region on a macro level, you can see mimicked on a micro level in Beirut because it does have this very unusual mosaic, as you said, of all the different ethnic and sectarian groups are all kind of there in one form or another, with the exception of the Kurds. So it's a great place to start your career in the Middle East in terms of understanding the broader dynamics at play.
What was it like? You mentioned then that Beirut was your base, a troubled base, to go back and forth to Baghdad. What was it like being at that age and suddenly having your base being, you know, civilian infrastructure being attacked, a sense of instability across the country, very sectarian conflict? What was it like going there and then going back and forth to Baghdad at that age? I mean, how did you rationalize that? How did you keep your mind on the right track?
I mean, I think I'm very fortunate and blessed in that I have an incredible family and an incredible network of friends who have been my best friends since I went to boarding school with them at, you know, 10, 11 years old. I grew up mostly in the UK, actually, partly in New York, but mostly in the UK. So I also made sure to come to London a lot and spend a lot of time with my girlfriends and really try to have something of a normal life, whether it's just making sure you go out for some nice meals with good girlfriends or see an exhibition or hang out with my parents and their dogs. I think that was definitely a key component. I also think that what nobody tells you when you get into this industry is the way that trauma works and the way that it manifests itself. It very rarely happens that you go and you cover a war and you see something terrible and then you go home and you cry a lot and you feel really sad. It doesn't usually happen quite like that. Well, it's a subjective experience, but for me, it doesn't usually happen quite like that. For me, it might happen that I go and I cover a war and I see some terrible things. And then I come back and I'm okay, but I'm a little bit more irritable than usual, or I feel a bit more disconnected, or it can take a long time before you connect the dots and realize, oh, wait, you know, 6 months later, I'm feeling suddenly really blue and I don't understand what the problem is because everything's fine. And only as you get older and are a little more evolved and have a deeper knowledge of self and just a little more self-aware, are you able to say, okay, all of this stuff actually is interconnected, and you don't necessarily always pay the piper right at the time you witness something or experience something. It can sometimes be a bit more insidious than that, or certain patterns will evolve. I think the best thing you can do is to be on top of it and be aware of it and be checking in with yourself a lot.
Did anyone, you know, these more seasoned reporters that you were meeting at that time, did any of them give you tips? How to roll with this, how to keep yourself on the right track? And is there anything that sticks in your mind?
You know, ironically, most of the reporters, I would have to say, when I was starting out and looking to the older generation, you know, a lot of people using self-medication, let's say, a lot of people sort of drinking a lot and, you know, making it work somehow. But the one person who gave me some really good advice that was a little more wholesome in its nature was Christiane Amanpour. And at the time I was working for CBS News and I was covering Syria a lot, and she was presenting me with the DuPont Award for some stories I had done in Syria. And she said to me, she sort of pulled me aside and she was like, you have got to have something of a normal life on the side. This can't be it. It can't be your whole life, because on a certain level, it cannot sustain you. So you have to have laughter and friendship and love and family you have to have something that acts as a kind of counterweight to everything you're experiencing. And I thought that was really good advice.
So after Beirut, you take up a job with ABC mm-hmm. and move back to Russia and start reporting around the Caucasus as well. Now, Clarissa, you have this amazing ability to kind of be in the wrong place at the right time, or the right place at the wrong time, however you look at it. You're in Georgia,
yeah.
and then suddenly the Russian army makes its incursion into South Ossetia.
Yeah.
First of all, describe for me that moment when you were in Georgia, when you found out that incursion was happening. What went through your mind?
Well, I was in Moscow and I flew to Georgia because of the incursion. But my first reaction was, honestly, wow, this is a really big story. And I wonder how long until I get bigfooted, because I was still very young. But actually, I was very fortunate. I did not get bigfooted. And I don't know if that was because I spoke some Russian or because no one else particularly wanted to go, or because everyone was more interested in covering other stories or having their summer vacation. But it was my first big story at ABC, where I was providing to all of the newscasts, Good Morning America, World News, Nightline, every single day. And I had never experienced anything like that level of demand or that level of hard work, honestly. I mean, it was 3 hours of sleep a day max. And when you're trying to cope with the stress of being in a war zone and being mindful of your security, plus the stress of making sure you're filing and getting enough material and doing good work, you realize that when you go into the zone, when you're covering a conflict like that, where it's all kicking off as you're there and you are expected to service all these different platforms, it is incredibly demanding. I mean, it is all consuming. There is nothing in your world during the course of that week or whatever, however long it was, except for this war and your work. I had had a sample or a taste of that before, but this was a different level. And in the end, I think it's the sort of thing you either find it incredibly stressful and think, why on earth would anyone want to do this? Or you find it tremendously exciting and you think, why on earth would anyone want to do anything else? I obviously fell into the latter category.
Did you ever have those moments of doubt where you thought, what am I doing here?
No, not really. If anything, I maybe have them more as I get older. But I mean, what a privilege to be witnessing history, to be in the thick of it, to be traveling all over the world and telling people's stories. I mean, to me, there is nothing more exciting.
So we talked then a little bit about Georgia and South Ossetia and the incursion. And obviously that sets an astonishing scene for what happens in the next few years. Everything from Russian restive influence in Eastern Europe, in Estonia, meddling in elections. We start to see that become such a dominant narrative of our time. Mm. But then that takes you also to Syria, doesn't it, in 2011. And then you joined CBS, of course, and become a correspondent for them. When you were there at the start of that uprising in Syria, how cautious were you about that revolution? Did you think this is going to go the way of the Free Syrian Army at that time? Did you think this is going to become the deadlock that it became in the next couple of years? What sort of reflections did you have at that moment?
I think potentially I would say there was, as the uprising continued and galvanized more and more support and more platitudes, they turned out to be, from the international community about Assad must go and this must stop. I think there were moments early on, certainly, where it seemed incomprehensible that President Assad would be able to remain in power. At the same time, having spent a lot of time with the rebels, particularly in their early incarnations, where they really had, I mean, they didn't even have two-way radios. They had no training. They had no idea what they were doing. I would say I didn't really invest a huge store of confidence in their ability to win a war that they were fighting with, you know, AK-47s, as I said, while they were at that stage, let's say before the aerial bombardment began, they were still getting hit relentlessly with artillery. So I wasn't overly optimistic that the rebels would be able to overthrow But there was a moment, I would say, in 2012, where there was a big bomb in Damascus, which killed a lot of very senior Assad cronies. And all of a sudden, the rebels were sort of encircling Damascus, it seemed. And there was a moment there where it seemed like, oh, boy, this is actually going to happen. But the moment was fleeting. And of course, at the same time, what we saw happening was the proliferation of jihadist groups, which we were covering from a very early period. And it was sort of obvious that that was going to have an incredibly negative impact on the uprising, that it was going to leave a very bad taste in the mouths of countries or various parties that were supporting the rebels, and that it was ultimately going to be extremely problematic. And sure enough, we saw that play out as we saw the rise of ISIS. I think what I've never really been able to, you know, it happens in any war that civilians bear the brunt. This is a sort of time-old adage, but in Syria, what civilians have gone through is just so extraordinary and so horrifying. And sometimes it does sort of confound me that there can be no justice for these people, that there can be no real silver lining for these people.
You mentioned before the platitudes that came from the international community. Do you feel now, when you see the last 6 years and how they've played out, that the world did drop the ball here? They did not meet the situation correctly?
Oh, I think there's no question. And I would say not because they didn't intervene, but because they gave a strong impression earlier on that they would intervene. And you have to remember, this was coming right on the heels of Libya. And whether or not you support what happened in Libya, it created something of a moral hazard. Because I can tell you, having gone to those early rallies where people were taking to the streets armed with posters and meeting a hail of bullets, that half the reason they were willing to do that and that they were willing to march into that hail of bullets was because they believed fundamentally that that would bring about international support in the form of some kind of a no-fly zone. And they believed that not because they were idealistic or stupid, but because they had seen it happen in Libya. And so that precedent was dangerous, ultimately. And then we heard from President Barack Obama repeatedly at the time, Assad must step down. Words do matter. And it's one thing if you say from the get-go, we're not getting involved, we're never getting involved, this is an internal conflict, these people have to resolve it themselves. It's another thing if you say, we're with you, this guy has to go, and if you're coming on the heels of a previous intervention, I have no doubt that Syria would have looked very different if people had chosen their words more carefully and chosen their actions more carefully.
I wonder, you know, you were there during the siege of Aleppo, and I'm sure you lost lots of Syrian friends in that process.
Mm.
Now, there are those people today who say, well, okay, Assad is a tyrant. And, you know, he has, you know, there is certainly evidence of what has happened there in terms of attacks on civilians and gassing and so on. But he's preferable to this mosaic of jihadist groups that we hear about and these proxies that operate there in Syria. When you hear that, this idea that Assad actually, to bring this war to an end, may need to remain. How do you respond to people when you hear that platitude?
Well, I would say a couple of different things. I mean, first of all, I think that anyone who watches Syria very closely would not probably say Assad must go immediately, tomorrow. It's got to happen. Any kind of transition will need to be done in a sort of, to the extent that it can be, a methodical, deliberate, structured, and well thought out transition. But beyond that, I think there's a certain naivete to the idea that, well, Assad's the better the devil you know. Because what people tend to forget is that the whole, or a big part of the reason that ISIS grew so quickly other than the sort of U.S. military intervention in Iraq, which is obviously a big component. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was, in fact, largely radicalized while he was in a U.S. prison camp in Iraq. So that's one part of it. But another big part of it, and a big component in terms of why we've seen this sort of seeming proliferation or spread of the rise of jihadist thought across the globe, suddenly infecting many young minds, especially here in the West, is because they saw that this man was butchering his people with impunity, whether he was gassing them, whether he was torturing them, whether he was shooting them or shelling them or bombing them, and that nothing was being done about it. And you have groups like ISIS who are whispering in the ears of young Muslims saying, you see, no one cares about you. No one cares if Sunni Muslims die. We're the only people who can defend you. We're the only people who will lay down our lives for you. And that is an incredibly persuasive narrative for many young Muslims. So I think it is a huge mistake to assume that President Bashar al-Assad can ever bring any degree of stability to that country in the long term. It's too much damage has been done. Too much blood has been shed. And perhaps most importantly, what a lot of people forget, 50% of the country has been displaced. Millions and millions and millions of Syrians are living outside of Syria now. Will those people ever go back if President Bashar al-Assad is president? Can they ever go back? Because goodness knows, if you have a relative who's been involved in any way with the rebellion or was even an activist, you can't go back to Syria. It's too risky. You could end up in a jail sort of hanging from your fingernails. And people know this. So as long as President Bashar al-Assad is in power, I don't see with any real meaning of the word peace that there can be peace. He has had victories on the battlefield. I would argue that they are Pyrrhic victories. If you call Aleppo a victory, it's a graveyard. It's a bunch of skeletons of buildings where a vibrant, beautiful city once was. These places need to be rebuilt. There needs to be an enormous amount of investment. Can that happen under President Bashar al-Assad? Will the international community sort of come together and start investing billions and billions of dollars in Syria? No, I don't think so. So while I wouldn't say that he needs to go right away, per se, the idea that he can be a long-term part of Syria's future, I think, is very short-sighted.
We live in a time where colleagues of yourself and our colleagues, people are dying in the field, working as journalists. They're being in prison, they're being detained, even in countries that we class as allies of the West. Is there an assignment you won't take now?
There are lots of assignments I won't take. I actually, ironically, I have quite a low risk threshold, especially the older I get, honestly. I do not love being shot at or being bombed. That Syria assignment was very specific and unique, I would say, in that I felt very strongly about the story and I had put so much work into planning it that I felt pretty good about the security component. But for the most part, I am really more interested in covering the stories of the people who are affected by war than I am in being that brave badass who's got bullets whizzing over their head as they're giving the blow-by-blow of what's happening in the war. I care about the civilians. That's what moves me. That's the component of the story that I feel really strongly needs to be told. Obviously, all the other elements are hugely important too, but I do not need to be a badass. I do not need to prove myself. I don't feel that urge anymore at all. I have done it before, and I think that risking your life is something that should not be done without a lot of thought and preparation and a kind of sense that you know what you're doing and that it's worth it and that it's the right story to do it for. Not every story is the right story to do it for.
Clarissa Ward, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on The Big Interview. The Big Interview is produced by Gaia Lutz and edited by Cassie Galpin. I'm Chris Lord. Thank you very much for listening.